The founder of Panasonic once said,
"We can lead more meaningful and constructive lives
through the pursuit of activities that will ensure
a better today than yesterday,
a better tomorrow than today."
Panasonic is committed to creating a greener,
more equitable future for everyone.
Explore Panasonic Green Impact
at na.panasonic.com/greenimpact.
This is Rob Long with Martini Shot for The Ankler. Once, not too long ago, I was flying back to L.A. from London, and the young woman in front of me checking in was doing her very best to finagle a free upgrade to first class. She was under the impression, I think, that the way to get an upgrade was just to ask for one, and then when refused, to call someone named Nigel on her cell phone and complain loudly, and then, after hanging up, turn to the person behind the tall check-in counter and say in a petulant tone of voice, "I'm actually quite well-known." Which, I don't know, might be true for all I know. There are a lot of quite well-known people who aren't quite well-known. For the record, I am not quite well-known, and I have a simple rule about air travel. If it is on me, it is very much a coach situation. If it's on anyone else, and I mean anyone else, I mean even if for some reason impoverished world disaster victims wanted me to come and tell them stories about Hollywood, it's business class or better. Now, the particular airline with a passenger who was unknown to me or the check-in agent, but who was nevertheless apparently quite well-known, had something called Economy Plus, which they try to trick you into thinking is just like business class, but trust me, I've flown it. It's impossible to detect exactly what's so plus about it. Better to just save your money and load up the iPad with movies, drink 6 glasses of red wine, fold yourself into coach, and sleep, snore, and drool your way to your destination. Now, I was flying back from somewhere once with my brother, and at the gate we ran into an agent I know. We were all waiting for the plane to begin boarding, and my brother and I were in something I think they called Zone 43. And after the polite chit-chat, the agent launched into a hugely complicated story about why exactly he was flying coach that day. He missed the first plane, see, and there wasn't any space in first on the next flight, so he switched airlines, then he couldn't upgrade, then the flight was canceled. It was a very strange, loopy tale filled with internal contradictions. And it was sad, really, because here I was scraping my knees into a coach seat, and it hadn't occurred to me to wonder what that said about me, you know, my little coach ticket and my sad Cinnabon. Not that I don't splurge sometimes, of course. I'm no grim-faced, lonely planet type marching around with a water bottle and a map and a sour expression. But for me, when I throw money on a plane ticket or a fancy hotel, I don't do it to impress people I know. I do it to impress people I don't know. I do it to make people at the hotel think I'm some kind of mysterious secret agent. I do it to shed the kind of thing and the kind of thinking that we all do sometimes here in Hollywood, wondering if our car sends the right message about us, if our house conveys the proper amount of success, if our iPhone is new enough, if our office is big enough. The trouble is, people in Hollywood want to be around people in Hollywood who are doing well. We're a superstitious bunch without too much rational thinking. Success to us is something that you can catch if you're close enough to it. And that's why you want to sit at the pointy end of the plane or be at the right table at the restaurant. You pull up to the intersection in the right kind of car. Success is contagious. And so is failure, or at least so is the slow slipping down that happens eventually to everyone in this business. I mean, I know it's not, and you know it's not, but for some reason around here, we often act like it is. So, at any airport gate, while a flight to LA is boarding, you can catch the locals checking each other out, trying to figure out who everybody is and where they're sitting. The agent I ran into at the gate those many months ago is now technically not in show business anymore. I'm not sure where he is, but the girl at the check-in desk, she did somehow get her upgrade. I know because I boarded the plane right behind her, and she turned left and I turned right, and the curtain swished close between us. And as I crammed my carry-on into the shoebox-sized space underneath the seat in front of me and shifted and twisted myself into a sad little coil, and despite the fact that I heard the girl at the counter essentially groveling for an upgrade, I caught myself thinking, wow, she must be doing pretty well. She must be awfully successful to be sitting up there. And then, you know, the wine kicked in and I drooled my way back home. But the lesson here is the trick is to act quite well-known even when you're not, to act like people know your name even when they don't. I'm really bad at remembering people's names. That's something that people in the entertainment business say a lot, mostly to explain why they've forgotten or maybe never really paid attention to somebody else's name. That person is usually somewhere way down on the call sheet or buried on a back page of the budget. People at the top of either document, well, they tend to get remembered. I'm terrible with names, some people say. Well, to be totally honest, I've said it. But it's sort of a kind of thing like being chronically late. I mean, yeah, it probably is an unconscious act, but it still reflects a certain ruthless budgeting of attention and energy. I mean, if you were more important, is the message, I would remember who you are. When I was first starting out in the business, I was sensitive enough to know exactly when someone had forgotten or maybe never bothered to learn my name. Sometimes it was on a soundstage and one of the actors would have clearly blanked on who I was. Sometimes it was in a rewrite session and one of the creators of the show would be sitting in and would know that he should know my name, know that he didn't know my name, know that revealing that fact would be embarrassing for both of us. And I'd sense all that terrible tension building up. There was a time when I was one of the co-showrunners of a hit TV show where the creators and executive producers had long since taken a step away from the day-to-day to spend their time flying around in private jets and buying things at auction. And even then, I was pretty sure they didn't know my name or at least weren't confident enough to say it out loud. So here's what I did. I wrote my name on the upper right-hand corner of that week's script, and I rolled the script up lengthwise, you know, real casual-like. And I held the script up next to my face, just casually like, oh, this is just how I hold my script when I'm thinking hard about running a TV show or whatnot. And I would make carefully sure that my name was visible and held in such a way as to be very close to my face. So if someone, one of my bosses or one of the stars of the show, wanted to speak to me, my name would be front and center and we'd both be spared that mortification. But that's what you do when you have a name, but not, you know, a name. It's mostly a writer's problem, actually. Famous faces and famous names go together, of course, and when you're casting, that's what you're looking for. You're looking for a name. That's what we call it, actually. We say, I think we need a name for this project, or that mother part, we could really use a name for that. There was a time not too long ago when the best way to cast a TV show was to make a list of the names of the biggest stars you could think of who were currently having money troubles. And then you'd work your way down that list until money troubles plotted on the x-axis and the size of the part plotted on the y-axis met, and suddenly, you'd have a name for your cast. It still sort of works that way with every job in Hollywood. Television's gotten a lot better, of course, but better these days because everything seems to be a version of a television show, even what we used to call movies. And so you might have to plot some more lines on that graph, the quality of the role maybe, the prestige of the writer, or other big names also appearing on that particular streaming service, or the existence of other offers, or the long silence since the last real one, all those things would factor in. And I'm not just talking about actors. Writers, too, have to make these kinds of calculations. Not too long ago, it was axiomatic that a writer with a show on one of the new fledgling platforms was either just beginning or winding down a career. But this is a business that deals in euphemisms, so we don't like to actually come out and say what's really happening. I mean, you'll never see an article in the trades announcing some recent piece of casting where a big movie name, say, suddenly joins the cast of a new TV pilot or series by mentioning that actor's current monthly expenses. Now, it'll be something about, like, you know, creative opportunities, or deeply drawn characters, or risk-taking, edgy material. Which will all be true, of course, but there's true and there's being upside down on a jumbo mortgage in the middle of an industry contraction. You know what I mean? So, we euphemize. I remember once when a certain project came my way, but one which required a fair dollop of humiliation and begging, telling my then-agent, okay, I'll do it. Just set up the meeting. Show me which ones to kiss and where, and I'll do it. You know what I like about you? My then agent asked. The speed with which I'll sell out for money, I said. No, not that, was the reply. Because you are not selling out. You're approaching the business with a philosophical attitude. That's what I like about you. You're a philosopher. A philosopher. I'm a philosopher. I'm philosophical. I'm meeting a probably insane former movie star at her house in Malibu Canyon and what was surely going to be some kind of writer-producer bake-off. I mean, there were other writers and producers scheduled for the same day. Some of them were waiting by the pool when I arrived, but, you know, it was a big piece of business, and I'm philosophical about that. When gas contracts, it throws off a lot of energy. When a business contracts, especially this one, which is itself so gaseous, it throws off a lot of new euphemisms. The other day, I was talking to a friend of mine who's an executive at a large production company, and he was complaining about some writer's deals he was trying to make. "Do you know what those guys expect?" he asked, incredulous. "Do they not know that a strike happened, that things are tough, that it's a different world?" So I asked him, I said, what are you offering? And he told me, and it was low, of course. Everything's lower now, but it wasn't all that low. I mean, it wasn't insultingly low. And what he was offering was a lot more attractive in some ways than what other places might offer, because his company is a lot more edgy and risk-taking. And yeah, I know. So I told him that. And he said, "You know what I like about you?" And I said, "The speed with which I'll sell out for money?" And he said, "No, not that. I like your entrepreneurial attitude." My entrepreneurial attitude. I'm an entrepreneur. That is the new euphemism for underpaid, which is good to know because we will be using it a lot in the next few years. And that's it for this week. Next week, we will learn or try to take criticism. For The Ankler, this is Rob Long.